guys start on time or five after?
Five after.
Yeah.
Standard.
Standard.
Is this your computer or is it Jesus?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe let's get started with today's RI seminar. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Emilio Frazzoli. He's an associate professor at the Aerospace and Aeronautics Lab at MIT, where he also graduated, got his PhD, and he's since been a professor at the University of Illinois and also UCLA, and he's back at MIT, and he also was in the Italian Navy and spacecraft dynamics specialist, and so he's been doing some very interesting work on planning and coordinating for dynamic vehicles and teams of dynamic vehicles. So without further ado,
okay, thank you, James, and thank you for inviting me here, for being here for this talk. This is what I will be talking about today. I will, talk about a class of what I call dynamic routing problems for and motion coordination for vehicle networks. Okay, and what I put here is that I'm interested in large-scale vehicle networks. This is all. Most of this is, algorithmic and theoretical work in understanding what are the fundamental limitations and performance that you can get out of these networks, especially as the, as a function of, as a function of this of the scale of the network. Okay. Before I get into the actual talk, let me acknowledge my collaborators. This is Alessandro Arcier, who was a postdoc with me at UCLA and at MIT, who is now at Penn State. John and Wright, Marco Pavone, who are students at UCLA and MIT, respectively. Ketan Savla, who is now a postdoc at MIT, and Francesco Bullo, who is a collaborator at, is a faculty member at University of California, Santa Barbara. Okay, so let me get me started. And this is, showing you, some examples from robots that I had the opportunity to work on. On the left, some of you who were involved with some Navy project may have already seen this movie. So this was work done with Eric Ferrand. This was in the days back when I was still a student at MIT, and we are working on autonomous helicopters able to perform acrobatics. Okay, so you actually will see here a helicopter performing possibly the fastest U-turn that you can make in the sky. Okay, so essentially what you do is, in this case, what the helicopter was doing is you go upside down, then pull up and reverse direction. Okay, on the right, there is some footage from a competition. I don't know if you heard of it. It was the DARPA Urban Challenge this year. So, so this was a case in which, of course, yeah, probably you've heard of it. You have this, ground vehicle able to navigate, autonomously for 60 miles, within traffic. Okay. So really, the reason why I'm showing this to you is that, just if you look at the problem of having, one UAV or one ground vehicle is, and you just leave it by itself with nothing else in the world. So it's a technology that is rapidly maturing. Of course, there's a lot of work to be done. And but now the focus is also shifting to other things. So for example, what I would like to mention is what I call here interaction in essentially networks that include several robots, or in general several moving agents. Okay, this can be several robots, can be robots with and human-driven vehicles, or whatever combination you like. Okay, and I say here interaction because I very intentionally wanted to avoid mentioning cooperation. So cooperation is one way of interaction; is not the only way of interaction. Okay. Now, and a lot of people will come to you and say, okay, so I want to do formation flight with 12 UAVs or something like that. Okay, but for me, the point there is why 12? Okay, so why do we want to have multiple, multi-agent systems? What's the point of having, all the headaches associated with flying, more than one airplane or operating more than one robot? So what I'm interested in is the understanding what are the costs or benefits associated with scale, communication between agents, and cooperation between agents. Okay, so really this is an analysis of the trade-offs between the achievable performance and the complexity of the system that you will get. Okay, whereby complexity I mean computational complexity, that is how much time you need to to run your algorithms, how powerful a computer you need to have, how much memory. But also communication complexity, that is, how much information do you need to transfer over the network to achieve your mission, okay? So this is, in general, the kind of like interest problem that I'm looking at. In particular, today I will talk about a class of problems which are really based on a classic. So this is called, class of problems is called the vehicle routing problems. Which is something that is very well studied in the operation research literature. Okay, so the vehicle routing problem in general is something like this. So you have a number of vehicles and you have some depots, so these are like a parking lots or something, and you have some customer locations and you want to design efficient routes for your vehicles to go and visit all the customers, okay, and then come back to the depot overnight. This is, of course, is a very central problem in lots of fields in transportation, logistics. Essentially, this is one of the most challenging combinatorial optimization problems. You can recognize that, for example, a traveling salesman problem is one instance of this where you have only one vehicle. Okay, so this is kind of like the basic problem. Okay. Now, however, if you look at this problem, this is something that is static and deterministic, right? So I tell you, okay, so these are the locations that you had to visit. So for example, I'm designing the routes for my buses in my city, right? Or maybe I'm trying to locate where I put my fire stations, police stations, in order to provide, rapid response. And so these are, but you do that once and for all, right? Or, you don't replan the bus schedule and the routes every day. And these are, real, usually purely geometric problems. And also you always have a centralized decision maker and you do all the planning offline, okay? So if we want to apply this for robotic applications where you have UAVs, roaming around in some, for example, battlefield, or you want to do some environmental monitoring or other kind of applications, really what you have to do is look at a more dynamic version of these problems, okay? So for example, I will look at really what I have is three components that I will change parameters in these three components to look at different problems. So first of all, you have a model of the user or of the environment. In particular, I will look at problems which are not stated completely a priori, okay? So all the information is not available a priori, but is revealed over time, for example, as it is being generated by some exogenous process, say a stochastic process, okay? So I don't know where the customers will be ahead of time, but I will get phones, phone calls from the customers asking me to go somewhere, okay? In terms of a system model, instead of looking at just simply at, vehicles that can travel in a straight line, I will also look at problems where the vehicles are subject to differential constraints, for example, okay? So, or in general have more complicated dynamics. We'll also look at local sensing and communication and limited onboard computational resources, okay? Also, in terms of performance criterion, when you have these dynamic problems, it doesn't really make sense to minimize, for example, the amount of fuel that you burn, okay? Because you will be, in any case, you will be flying, waiting for, things to happen. So really the correct performance criterion is not how much fuel you burn, but, the quality of service that you provide to your customers, okay? So we look at quality of service metrics like average delay, average delay or reliability or similar metrics. Okay, so let me get started with the simplest version of these problems. And this is something that's been called the traveling repair person problem, okay? Think of a dynamic version of the traveling salesman problem, okay? So now you have your technician that is traveling around the city on their van, okay, or truck, and then they get calls from customers, okay? So please come to my home, fix the laundry machine or something, right? Now, what they want to do is they want to keep their customers happy, right? So they want to minimize the delay between the phone call and the time they go to the on-site, okay? So how do we model these phone calls for the customers? So what I would say is that these service requests are generated by a Poisson process, okay? So Poisson process generates these events. Essentially, Poisson process generates the phone calls, okay? So then each phone calls, once it is, once you receive it, you know, the customer tells you where their house is located, okay? So each of these events is associated to a location in some planar region, okay? And the density of, and you know, this location is sampled from a distribution, probability distribution, let's call it phi. The time intensity of the Poisson process is lambda, okay? So essentially what you get is lambda new arrivals per unit time on average, okay? And when a new arrival, you know, is generated, it's placed somewhere according to phi. For now, let's consider just a single vehicle moving on the plane with bounded speed, okay? Very reasonable. And then my performance criteria will be to minimize the average waiting time between the time I get the phone call and the time I go visit the customer, okay? So this is a problem that was really formulated in the late 80s, and really Bert Simas and his students, Van Rysen, mainly Van Rysen, really solved the problem, and you know, they had a very comprehensive set of results. And they provide lower bounds on the average waiting time, and also they provide centralized policy providing almost optimal performance. Okay, so now what we want to do is, you know, build on this work and see how we can do it online in a decentralized way. Okay. So we will need a little bit of background and what is called the stochastic traveling salesman problem. So essentially, you know the traveling salesman problem, right? So it's finding the shortest, you know, close path through endpoints in the plane. Now let's assume that that I generate these endpoints randomly from, let's say, from a distribution phi, okay? So then there is this very nice result. It's kind of surprising that if you define this random variable, this ETSP stands for Euclidean Traveling Salesman Problem. Okay, so this would be the length of the optimal tour through n randomly sampled points. Okay, so this is itself a random variable. And now you take the limit when this number of points is very large. Then what happens is that this limit converges to this constant, almost surely. Okay, so essentially what we have is a deterministic limit. In the case that, you know, we'll be more mostly interested in, the dimension of the environment is 2. So essentially what you have here is that almost surely the length of the optimal tour will scale as the square root of the number of points that you have to visit. Okay, so this is a fundamental result that we will use. This constant beta is something that has been computed through simulation, you know, there people who have devoted their life to professional life to computing this constant. Okay. Anyway, you know, some nice properties of this is that actually this result holds for any compact set, actually for any bounded set Q. Okay. So this set doesn't have to be convex, doesn't have to be simply connected, doesn't have to be connected at all. Okay. So you can have like two connected components. That's fine. Also, if you think of it, you know, the formula that I put on the slides before was a function of the target density, but the target density can be upper bounded by the by essentially 1. Okay, so essentially what this is saying is that the worst case is attained when the targets are generated from a uniform distribution. Okay, so that's the worst thing that can happen. Okay, so essentially every time you have a non-uniform distribution, you get some cost saving because essentially when the targets are clustered, the average cost per target is lowered. Yeah.
I'm confused in that if you lay down points on a grid, it seems to me the minimum tour is always going to be closely related to the number of points rather than the square root of the number of points. So why does randomizing the points change that?
Well, actually, no. What it turns out, if you deterministically place the point to maximize the length of the tour, okay.
So I'm just laying them on a grid.
So if you do the calculation, remember that the environment size is bounded, right? So let's say that you have a square, a unit square, you want to put endpoints. Okay, you put them on a grid, for example. You go through all of them. The length of this tour is actually grows with the size of the side of the square. Okay, that is grows. The other way around. The length of this tour grows with the square root of n. So you have exactly the same result. So the only thing that changes is that in the case you put the points in any arbitrary way to make this thing as large as possible, the only thing that changes is this constant, okay, which is higher. And in the case in which you place these points arbitrarily, that constant depends on the shape of the environment, whereas in the stochastic case, that constant does not depend on the shape of the environment. Okay? But the scaling is exactly the same. Okay, is again square root of n. Okay, so just if you do it carefully, that's what you get. Okay, so this was some background. So let me just state a policy that works very well and actually is conjectured to be optimal. Okay, so it works as follows. So let's say that, okay, so this is time zero. I open my eyes and I see, so these are all the customers waiting. Okay, so what do I do? What I will do is the following. I will set a certain parameter eta, which is the fraction of targets that I'm willing to visit. Okay, and then I will look for the, let me call it the densest cluster of that contains at least a fraction eta of those of the outstanding targets. Okay, so in this case, you know, for example, I want to visit at least 5 targets. The densest cluster is formed by these 5. So then what I will do is I will go visit these 5 in the most efficient way. Once I visited them, and you know, while I do this, I completely ignore other targets that may be appearing. Okay. Once I'm done with that, I open my eyes again, look at the new targets, and redo exactly the same thing. Okay. What do I mean by densest cluster? So essentially what you will do is you know the Kruskal's algorithm for computing minimum spanning trees. Okay, so essentially you have a forest of trees that are, and you know, if you think of it, you know, each cluster here contains is the densest cluster that contains at least that particular number of points. Okay, so it's actually easy to find this densest cluster. You do the just Kruskal's algorithm, which is a polynomial time algorithm. As soon as you get the first cluster that contains at least the number of points that you desire, that's the densest one. Okay, so now, okay, so this is what you do when there are customers that are waiting for service. If there is nobody waiting for service, what you will do is kind of obvious. So what you will do is try to go towards some kind of a centroid of your environment. Actually, the correct point that you have to go to is something that is called the median or the Fermat-Torricelli point, or also called the Weber point. So the Weber point is the point that minimizes the average distance to the, you know, to any point in the environment. Okay.
Sorry, I think I'm a little lost. Uh-huh. The problem that you're solving with the traveling repair person problem.
Yeah.
I thought we find out on the fly where those red dots are.
Yeah. So this is a receding horizon strategy, right? So what I do is, I open my eyes at time zero,
okay,
and I look at the targets that are outstanding at this given time, okay? And then I apply this policy to the currently outstanding targets, okay?
So it's as if you got a phone call with all those dots at once, and then as time goes on,
I may be getting other phone calls.
Uh-huh.
I don't care, okay?
Okay?
So what I do is I just, you know, service these ones, right?
Uh-huh.
When I'm done with this, I remove these ones from my queue, there will be the new ones that have called in the meantime.
Okay.
So essentially, I ignore my telephone for a while, right? So when I'm done, then I check my voicemail. Okay. Okay. Good. Now, what happens if you analyze this policy? What happens is that essentially lambda is very small, that is, at most times there are no outstanding targets, then this is easy to see that is optimal, right? Because you always put yourself in the best possible position to go visit the next target, okay? But also, if you do all the calculations, you see that when lambda grows and becomes very large, then your performance approaches this limit, okay? And you see that the performance gets better as this parameter eta goes to zero, okay? So essentially, as you make the horizon shorter and shorter, okay, the performance gets better. So essentially, you are more and more reactive, in a sense. Okay. Of course, you cannot set this to zero exactly, right? So as eta goes to zero, then you approach the performance beta squared over 2 times these other factors, and which is actually, this is the best, you know, the performance of the best known centralized algorithm. Of course, I mean, here in this single vehicle case, doesn't make sense to speak about centralized or decentralized. Yeah.
So earlier you had suggested you would service all 5,
yeah,
which means this eta parameter,
yeah, yeah,
a little strange. If you make it small, can't you run into easily into situations where you dither and get stuck?
Very good point. Keep in mind that this limit is really valid when lambda goes to infinity, right? So if you service, if eta is very small as you like, but it's a constant, but you make lambda go to infinity, eta times lambda also goes to infinity, okay? And actually, you will see in the experimental result that really a trick to make this work is that you have to make sure that eta times lambda is a large enough number. Large enough, really, 10 is actually enough, okay? So it doesn't have to be, you know, 1 million. About 10 is right, okay? Let me show you the result. So this is the, you know, the solid line is the theoretical prediction, and all the dots are, you know, what happens with simulation. And actually, if you see here, let me show it with a little hand here. Okay, so you see that, you know, for low lambda, low values of lambda, you see that when eta gets too small, actually the performance decreases. Okay, and this is exactly because of the reason, because now lambda is too small, so you're actually just going to visit 1 or 2 points. Okay. So, and then the asymptotic limits for the traveling salesman problem don't hold, and so you suffer in performance, okay? But in the case where lambda gets very large, you see that actually, you know, the optimum gets when eta gets closer to zero. So why does this work? You know, because you can think of another policy that, you know, it's much simpler, that is always go to the nearest neighbor, right? Because this is actually the question that I get. So if eta has to go to zero, just go to the nearest one. That's not the same, and so this is a movie where you have, you know, this Pac-Man, you know, always trying to go to the nearest neighbor. You know, it's a good policy. Actually, you can prove that, you know, performance is not too bad. The problem here is that by being greedy, the Pac-Man may be tricked into going to places where there are isolated targets, which is not a good idea. Okay, because anytime there is an isolated target, the cost per target is very large for that one. And you know that if you wait long enough, eventually that isolated target will no longer be isolated. Okay, so essentially, if you get a phone call from a customer in some remote town, and you know he's the only one, well, you know, ignore him until you get, you know, a few more calls from the same town. Okay, and actually, so you see here, this is the you know, simulation of the policy that I just presented, which, you know, let's call it densest cluster. You see that here. You know, just because of the stochastic nature of this point generation process, you will see that, you know, sometimes some targets, you know, appear to be more densely clustered, right? You see that anytime you see a bunch of targets which are clustered, you can be sure that in a couple of iterations the vehicle will go visit them, right? So, for example, probably, you know, soon we'll go to these points here. Yeah. Okay. So essentially, you're always trying to go to the targets that are densely packed because these are now the cheapest to service. Okay, ignore the isolated ones, because if you wait a little bit, they will no longer be isolated. Okay, so this is the intuition. And actually, you can prove that, we can prove the performance. For the nearest neighbor policy, actually, there is no known analytic result on the performance. Okay, but if you do simulations, you find that for eta less than 0.7, you actually beat the nearest neighbor performance. Okay. Good. So essentially what I do is I grow, you know, I use the algorithm for building minimum spanning trees. It's due to Kruskal, right? So the Kruskal algorithm is a greedy algorithm for forming minimum spanning trees. Essentially what I do is I start with all the points, right? All the points are small trees in this forest, right? And then I start, you know, adding edges and joining 2 different trees, starting with the edges with minimal cost, right? So the only thing I try to do is I make sure that I don't close cycles, that all these trees are trees, right? So no cycles, okay? So, and as soon as one of the trees hits the, you know, that number of points, that I know is the tree with the densest tree with that particular number of points. Okay, I mean, it can happen that, for example, I join two trees, and so I kind of like go beyond, you know, that limit, but then I take any part, and it's fine.
So right. Clustering step also happens only once you've finished servicing all the nodes in a particular cluster, and then you take it to a part of the new service request.
Yeah. In principle, that's assuming like instantaneous computation, right? Or you can do it, you know, a little bit in advance when you know that you're almost there. Okay. Very good. So now, how do we extend this to the multiple vehicle case? Yeah.
Consider a case where a customer is very near, and there's only one customer who is near, but there's a big cluster which is far off.
You could. But you know, in the asymptotic case, you don't gain anything by doing that. Okay, so I mean, I'm not claiming that this is optimal for all values of lambda, right? So, so this policy is optimal when lambda gets very large. So, having you know the very unlikely case where you have somebody who is very close, okay, you may gain a little bit, but you know that doesn't really matter in the asymptotic sense. So, you could improve it, but asymptotically, this is good enough, okay?
Can you say anything about how long the max time for the customer would have to wait?
The maximum time?
Yes.
No. So, see, I mean, when you're dealing with probabilistic systems, then, you know, it's a little bit hard to prove, you know, bound on the maximum. What you can prove is that, so we can prove a convergence in the expected time. Also, the variance on the expected time goes to zero. Okay, so really, this is the time that they have to wait. Okay, but I cannot prove it that the worst case is that. Okay, good. So how do we extend this to the multiple vehicle case? Let me do this. So when you have a multiple vehicle case, what happens? So really, the problem is split into two subproblems. One is how to do the task assignment. That is, you know, given a certain target, who has to go and visit it? And then the other problem is the path planning, right? So in a sense, you know, given a certain number of tasks that you have to, or targets that you have to go visit, what is the best path, right? So let me just do this. Let me just arbitrarily come up with a partition of my environment, okay? And I arbitrarily choose a Voronoi partition generated by n points, okay, where each one of these generators is associated to one of the vehicles. Okay, I do this in a completely arbitrary way. Okay, so then, you know, given this, what you can do is compute, you know, okay, so this guy has this region. So all the targets that appear in this region will be serviced by this guy, right? So now this guy completely ignores the other ones and applies just the policy that I described before, okay? You can do your calculations, and you can compute what is the expected, you know, waiting time for each for the targets, okay? And of course, this will be a function of the of where you put the generators, right? So this will be a function of your partition, okay? And essentially, what we will try to do is, so this is a function of the partition. So then, what we will try to do is, how do you change the partition in such a way that these expressions are minimized? Okay, let me start first. Let's look at the light load case. So light load case is the case in which, you know, targets are generated very rarely, right? So most of the time there is nothing going on. So what you want to do is make sure that the your performance is actually proportional to this function here, which is also called the Weber function. So this is a function that measures what is the average distance to the next, you know, randomly sampled point from the closest agent, okay? So this is a function that is called, you know, the Weber function in the facility location literature. This is, you know, minimizing this is known to be an NP-hard problem when the number of generators is at least two. Even in the single agent case, there is no algebraic solution, okay? But this function is differentiable almost everywhere. So, you know, something that you can do is, you know, use a gradient algorithm, okay? So essentially what you do is assign an initial generator to each one of the agents, right? Then each agent, what they will do is, they will just do the residual horizon policy within their own region, right? And at the same time, or even asynchronously, what they can do is move their own generator according to a gradient descent law. Okay? Now, a gradient descent law really, you know, in principle, this would be a function. So this is the function that you're trying to minimize, which is a function of all the generators, right? And you're trying to move the ith generator according to this partial derivative or to this gradient, right? Now, the nice thing is that actually if you do the calculations, and the calculations here are actually very similar to the calculations that appear in another paper on coverage by multi-agent systems by Francesco Bullo, Jorge Cortez, and Sonia Martinez, and others. So essentially what they minimize is the same thing, but there is a square here, okay? So that's what they do. So they're essentially minimizing convergence to something is a centroidal partition. Here what we do is a different problem, so we have to minimize just the average distance, okay, not the distance square. But in any case, what happens is that this gradient only depends on this function inside each agent's own Voronoi region, okay? And each agent's Voronoi region only depends on its neighbors, okay? So in order to compute this guy Voronoi regions, I only need to talk to this one, and this one. Okay? So in this sense, this control law will be decentralized in the sense of the Delaunay graph, right? So I only talk to somebody if this other agent is shares in like an edge of my Voronoi cell, okay? So here, really, what happens is that it is known that the Delaunay graph has a number of edges that is linear in the number of agents or number of points, which means that the number of edges per node per vertex in the graph is actually constant, right? Actually, is So the number of messages that each agent has to communicate to other guys is just a constant. Okay.
Gradient. Uh-huh. So if it's been squared, you're going to the centroid of the Voronoi region.
Yeah.
So what are you going toward? Is there is something comparable that you're going toward here?
Yeah. So it's called the median, right? So is the median is the is this Fermat-Torricelli point? Is the point that minimizes the average distance to the random? Okay. So the point that minimizes the expected distance to a point that is sampled randomly from the region, okay?
That's the median, okay.
That's called the median, just a definition.
Right.
Okay, so, okay? And then in this case, you're converging to a configuration in such that all these points are actually at the medians of their own Voronoi regions, okay?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay? Oh, it's similar, it's not the same, okay? Okay, now what you have is that the system time converges to a critical point of this Weber function. And so essentially, locally, you converge to optimal, right? So if you have an optimal configuration, if you are close enough, you will converge to it. That's all we can say, right? So usually with gradient algorithms. Okay, let me show you how this works. Okay, so let's say that we have a bunch of agents, and then you have some process that generates these target points, okay? You see, so the square, the yellow squares are the generators, and you see that they converge to what is very evidently a fair partition of this environment, right? Now, the nice thing is that, I can do this, and I can add new agents, right? And you see that they, still distribute themselves nicely while capturing all the targets, so on and so forth, okay? Good. Let me move forward. Okay, so now what we have here is that we have a policy that converges in the light load case to what is known to be optimal performance. Okay, communication with essentially with constant with the amount of communication that does not increase with the number of vehicles. Okay, so also if you think of it, the optimal performance would be order of 1 over square root of the number of points, because that would be the average distance to the, 1 over the square root of the number of agents. So that would be, that's how the scale of, the dimension of each region changes as a function of m. Okay. Now the question is, can we do any better? So can we achieve the same performance, but for example, not talking at all to one another, okay? So essentially what we want to do is achieve the same, you know, what will happen in the case in which you cannot communicate. So let's formulate this as a non-cooperative game. And the game is as follows. So we have M agents on the plane. These agents can possibly move at different speeds, okay, different maximum speeds. You have a target that is generated randomly from this distribution phi. Okay? All the agents know where the target appears. Okay? Now, the agent that visits the target first gets a unit reward. All the others don't get anything. Okay? Think of this as a piece of food. Okay? So there is a piece of food that appears somewhere. If you go get it, you get to eat it. All the others don't get anything. Right? Agents do not know how many other agents there are, okay, and cannot communicate to them. And agents also do not know the target distribution phi. Okay? So it actually is a much more difficult problem than the one that we were dealing with before. Now, here what you do is you repeat this game a large number of times. Essentially, this corresponds to doing the light load case of the problem that I described before. Right? So essentially, you only have at most one target at any given time. Okay, so how do you describe the solution to this game? Right? So you have to come up with a strategy for each one of the agents. Okay, so essentially the strategy is the following. What, the only thing that you have to decide is where to wait for the next target. Okay, because when there is a target, the best thing you can do, you don't know where the other guys are, you don't know how many other people there are, so you just go try to get it. Right? So the only decision is deciding where to wait. Then you can define this individual utility, right? So the utility for you is the probability that you actually are the one who gets the target, okay? So essentially this is, the reward is one if you were smart enough to wait at the right point, okay? And it's zero otherwise, okay? So this is the utility for the agent. Don't forget what is the collective utility, right? Remember that really what we want to do is we don't care about which agents get to eat the most. What I care about is that these targets are removed from the environment as quickly as possible. Okay, so my collective utility is again the expected value of the minimum distance scaled by the speed of the agents. Okay, very good. Any questions? So then I define this this Nash equilibrium. Essentially, if I have a set of strategies such that no one of these agents can deviate unilaterally from that strategy vector with an increase in performance. Okay? It's very good. Now, this game has some nice property in the sense that it is a potential game. In particular, it's an ordinal potential game. That is, a game is said to be an ordinal potential game if you have the following. So let's say that you have this individual utility, okay? And let's say that agents J's utility changes from, say, PJ prime to PJ double prime, okay? So if this is an advantage for agent J, it also means that this other function increases, okay? And we call this function psi a potential function. And we also say that the game is such that the utilities are aligned with the collective utility if the collective utility is a potential function for the game. Okay? So essentially, you see here, so you have a utility for the collective that is getting rid of targets as quickly as possible, and the utility for the agent that is eat as much as possible. The two things are actually aligned, right? Because if you are in a strategy that allows one of the agents to eat targets more efficiently, right, more quickly, it also removes targets from the environment more quickly. Okay? And actually what happens is that in an ordinal potential game, which satisfies this alignment condition, what happens is that if you have a policy that minimizes the collective performance or maximizes the collective utility, that is also a Nash equilibrium. Okay? So essentially we use this to prove that this policy is actually optimal, or actually leads to a Nash equilibrium. And the policy is the following. Okay, so what you do is, you're waiting somewhere. If there is a target, go try to get it, okay? All other guys will also try to get the same target. Only one of them will win, okay? Now what you do is you keep a memory of where the targets that you actually got were in the past, okay? When there are no targets available, what you will do is you look at those points that you got in the past and move to the median of those points. Okay? So essentially the idea is, if I know that I was successful hunting in a certain region, what I will do is I will try to move to the median of that region. Okay? Notice that this, you know, I don't know how many other guys there are. I don't know what they are doing. I don't know where they are. Okay? But still, actually, this will converge to a set of critical points of my collective utility, which actually coincides with the set of the pure Nash equilibrium. Okay? So essentially here what we have is the same convergence properties of the gradient descent law that I described before, but now you have the advantage that people are not talking to one another. Let me show you a simulation. Now in the simulation I'm actually doing a slightly different problem. So here, just to make the movie prettier, what I will do is the following. An agent moves to get a target. So in this case the agents can see their neighbors, okay? And an agent moves to get a target only if it is the closest agent to that particular target. Okay, so essentially you try to avoid duplication of effort. Okay, because if you see somebody else that is closer than you are to the target, probably they will get them, so you can just as well wait. Okay, don't waste energy. And look, you know, essentially this has some interesting features. So here I was a little sloppy with differentiating no smooth functions, but you know, this chattering will go away soon. Okay. Okay, so this is what is happening. Something that you may notice is that sometime, you know, these Voronoi regions are just drawn for the, you know, for your convenience, okay? So the agents don't know about this. Okay? But sometimes you will see that agents will move into some other agent's territory. Okay? What's the point of this? Why does this happen? So essentially, if I'm neighbor with somebody else, this somebody else is busy chasing a target somewhere else in their environment, and I'm kind of close to the fence, then I will just grab the food, okay? Okay? But otherwise, you see that, you know, the agents will try to stay at the, you know, the median of their own region and not to encroach too much into the other agents' regions, okay? So essentially, here this is a case where territoriality really arises as an optimal strategy, okay? Which is kind of contrary to the common wisdom in biology, where in order to maintain a territory, you have to defend it, okay? And if you have somebody who is trying to come in, you have to kind of like attack them or something like that. Whereas here, really you have this optimal coordination that doesn't arise through cooperation, right? Because, you know, each agent is not interested in increasing some other agent's, you know, utility. I'm just trying to increase my own, okay? But by doing this, essentially, they attain an efficient, partition of the environment, okay?
I can't think of one, but I guess I imagine it's an antagonistic example where one agent goes into another zone, and then there's one more little piece of food that's a little bit farther away, so we'll go after that one. And I guess he's
Yes, excellent point. Remember that. So these results are true when lambda is sufficiently small.
Okay, so that means no new.
So essentially, you know, this event that you're mentioning, that there is this daisy chain, you know, of food items. That's very unlikely.
Okay.
So essentially, a condition for this to hold is that, you know, the agents have the opportunity to return to their waiting point infinitely often.
Okay.
Okay. So that's all you need.
In what sense are these algorithms stable? The concern I might have.
Yeah.
These are UAVs. Is that I might have UAVs flying around a lot and things never settle down.
No. So this is so you can prove that here you have convergence to, you know, from any initial conditions. Actually, it's for
assuming
any.
Assuming this perfectly random source of targets
is not perfectly random, as long as the target generation rate is small enough, then this will converge. Okay, and you know this is not like an epsilon, so you can actually compute. You know there is some value, which is actually a function of the number of agents. As long as lambda is less than this finite number, then you have convergence, okay? I mean, of course, you see here that you know, what's the catch? So essentially here my claim is that communication doesn't help in the sense that I can get exactly to the same, I converge exactly to the same set of configurations. Where's the catch? You know, if I can communicate, I think that I can do a little better, right? Any idea? That movie is still playing, right? So actually what happens is that the opportunity, the ability of the agents to communicate with one another does not impact the quality of the final configuration, but affects how quickly you find that configuration. Okay? So essentially the ability to communicate really buys you much better performance in terms of transient. Okay? But doesn't buy you anything in terms of final steady state efficiency. Okay? I think this is kind of neat. If you're familiar with the literature on vector quantization, you may recognize that the gradient-like algorithm that I described before is actually an implementation of the Lloyd's algorithm for vector quantization. This game-like formulation is an equivalent of McQueen's algorithm for vector quantization. Okay, so these are the two main algorithms for doing solving that kind of problems, which have a nice application in this particular set of class of problems with vehicle routing. Okay. Let me talk about the heavy load case. Now, remember, so if you if you do the calculations, really what happens is that the optimal, so the system time is something that depends on the sum of the areas, or more in general, of the measures of each one of the regions to the to the third power. Okay, what is the minimum of this? So remember that the sum of all the measures of all this set, or the sum of all the areas, must be equal to the area of the environment, right? So we had this constraint. So under, subject to that constraint, what is the optimal value of the system time? Actually, the optimal value is attained when all the measures of all the areas are actually, or all the measures of all the regions are actually equal, okay? So, and such a partition where all the measures are of the each region are equal is called an equitable partition. Okay, so if you think of these, the measure of a region as a measure of the load on one of the agents, really what you want to do is do like a fair load balancing. Okay, so you want the load on each one of the agents to be the same. Okay, so the idea here, can we find such an equitable partition in a decentralized way? So ideally, what you could do is again do a gradient descent algorithm. The gradient computation is, again, spatially decentralized. However, the problem is here that for a general distribution, for a general phi, it is not known whether or not there exists a Voronoi partition that is equitable. Okay? So the constraint there is that I'm not choosing any general partition. I put the constraint that I'm using a Voronoi partition. And it seems that the Voronoi partition is too much of a constraint. Okay? So what I will do is we relax a little bit this constraint, and we will look at another kind of partition that I will define shortly. Essentially, let me define this distance. So this is a generator, okay, and let me associate to this generator a certain weight, okay, which is non-negative, W. Okay. Now I will define the Laguerre distance between a certain point to this weighted generator as the distance from that point to essentially the tangent to this circle of radius, to the circle center at G with radius W. Okay. This is also called the power of the point Q, that is that point over there, with respect to this circle. Okay. So now I can use this notion of a distance to define an equivalent of Voronoi diagrams, which are actually called power diagrams. Okay? So essentially, the definition of power diagrams is exactly the same as the definition of a Voronoi distance, where instead of Voronoi diagrams, where instead of using the Euclidean distance, I use this Laguerre distance. Okay? It's exactly the same thing. And in particular, this is a superset of Voronoi diagrams, because when all the weights are the same, then you get Voronoi diagrams. Okay? And has all the nice properties of Voronoi partitions. And actually, it turns out that for any density and for any convex bounded workspace, there is always exist a power diagram that is equitable. Okay? Okay, so now this is the, you know, what the details look like. Essentially now what the partition is defined not only by the generators, but also by the weights of the generators. Now when you do your gradient descent, you have to compute the gradient with respect to both the generators and the weight. Calculations look like this, okay? And then here you also show that you converge again to the set of critical points, and you have, you know, decentralized computation in the sense of these power diagrams. Okay, so this is, for example, what happens. So the radius of the circles is the weight of the agents, of the generators.
Are you given the power, an initial power diagram at first, and then you perform gradients on that?
Or yeah. Okay. So essentially, what I do is I assign to each agent a weight of to each generator a weight of zero. Okay. So essentially, I start with the Voronoi diagram, okay, and then I tweak things by using this weight, right? So if I see that, you know, my neighbor's region is too large with respect to mine, I will increase my weight, right?
So I'm challenging you on how decentralized this is, because it seems like is something an initial piece of information that everyone has to know.
Okay. So essentially, what you do, this happens, for example, when I introduce another agent in the environment, right? So, and I do the same thing, right? So I start with zero weight, right? And I have no region at all, right? Then I will start increasing my weight until I get a non-empty region, okay? So, but it's actually, this is a very good point. So there are ways that you can compute Voronoi diagrams in a decentralized way. It's a little bit tricky. But it's doable. So Chris Agikostis actually has some results on this. And they're in Francesco's paper, actually. So what's the question?
Is there an issue with local optimum?
Oh, yes, there is an issue. So all gradient-based algorithms, I mean, if the objective function is not convex, you know, all you can say is that you converge to the set of critical points. Actually, I think that here we are a little bit luckier in the set. So we converge to the set of critical points minus local maxima, okay? So we don't get stuck to the really bad points. Okay? Good. I think that is getting a little late. So
customer impatient.
Customer impatient. Let me just, you know, mention this. You know, you can do very similar things in other cases where, for example, here, you know, the agents were appearing and waiting forever. You can also do the version of the problem where customers may wait for a little bit, and then, you know, after a while they get bored and they just walk away. Okay. Now here doesn't make sense to look at, you know, what is the time that a customer stays in line, because if the customer leaves, that's not useful to you. So really the problem that you had to look at is what is the minimize the percentage of customers lost due to their impatience. Okay. I will not go through all the calculations, but essentially what we can get is that we can compute what is the minimum number of agents that you need to satisfy a certain performance criterion. Okay, this number is not necessarily the optimum, but we can prove that the ratio between the number that we compute and the optimum number is no more than 2.6. Okay, so essentially we have a constant factor approximation. Very good. Other problems that we have looked at is, you know, exactly the same kind of problems that I've described so far. But now what you also put is now agents not only, you know, no longer can fly any straight line path. They are subject to the constraint of bounded curvature. Why am I doing this? Because essentially I want to do exactly the same thing. I want to do it with airplanes. Okay? So now it's no longer somebody, you know, driving around on a truck, but it's somebody flying with an airplane, okay, or a truck which has, you know, it's not very maneuverable. Okay? We don't have time to go through this, but what I would like you to notice is that, for example, if you just look at the static case in which you have to visit a number of points, so essentially we are trying to do the traveling salesman problem with bounded curvature. What we have is something that is very similar in form to that limit that I showed you for the Euclidean case. Now what happens is that the length of these Dubin's, traveling salesman tour actually scales as the number of points that you had to visit to the power 2/3, right? Whereas in the Euclidean case, this scaling was with the power 1/2, okay? So now you see that the problem, of course, is more difficult. Unfortunately, we don't have a deterministic limit. We only have bounds. Okay. How this applies to the multiple vehicle case? It actually is very interesting that now the performance. Is actually, remember that M is the number of vehicles. So the performance now increases, the waiting time decreases with M, the number of vehicles, to the cube. Okay, in the Euclidean case, this dependency was with the number of vehicles squared. So that what we see here is that the problem is much more difficult. Okay, so we depend now, the waiting time depends on the square of lambda. So we are much more sensitive to lambda. Before it was just lambda, not the square. But the good news is that the advantage that I get from having several vehicles is much more than in the previous case. Okay, so now performance increases with the cube of the vehicles as opposed to the square. And how do you do it is, let me just show you. Oops. Essentially, the way you do it is no longer you divide the region into, say, Voronoi regions. Okay, so now what you want to do is you want to minimize the amount of turning that you do. So you had to divide the region into strips that are kind of like long and thin, okay? Because every time you had to make a U-turn, you're wasting time. Okay, so you want to minimize the number of U-turns that you make, okay? So essentially what you have here, you have all these agents that are kind of like scooping up targets, you know, always flying in a certain direction and making a U-turn, coming back, okay? So there is no coordination between these agents, but you see that they are kind of like a proceed, you know, along a front, a common front. Good. I think I will stop here. Okay. So there are a lot more of variations of this kind of problems that I can talk about, given enough time. But what is nice is that for all these variations, what we can do is design efficient algorithms, which are actually provably efficient. Okay. And what we get is that we also get a nice. So these are. Efficient, scalable algorithms. We can prove, how much the complexity scales with the number of vehicles, with the number of targets that you have. But what is interesting is that we can provide an exact characterization of how the performance scales with the number of vehicles. Okay, so we found that in the Euclidean case, when you are in heavy load, performance increases with the square of the number of the vehicles, which is a good argument if you want to go to the general and, oh, you had to buy, twice as many UAVs, right? And the guy say, why? I can give you four times the performance. Right. So that's a good argument, right? Actually, in the case of UAVs, the performance scales with the cube of the number of vehicles, which is even better, right? So I think that this is something that is very useful. Now, and if you look at these problems, really the, we have mentioned, Poisson processes, queuing systems, Voronoi diagrams, game theory. So you see that there are a lot of tools from a whole lot of different disciplines that come into play into designing algorithms for these kind of problems, and which I think that really opens the door to developing novel tools that integrate all these different different disciplines. For example, an example is that solving that traveling salesman problem with bounded curvature, that is, it's a combinatorial problem with differential constraint. Okay, this problem is very simple to state. Nobody has been able to solve it. So every time you do path planning for UAVs through a number of waypoints, is most often is always like a heuristic or brute force searches. Okay, whereas here what I was able to do is give a polynomial time algorithm which has probably good performance. Okay, but you have to the only way you can do it is looking at tools from combinatorial optimization and from essentially optimal control. Okay, and combine them together in some nice way. And I think that looking at the problem this way gives some very nice new fundamental and general insight into the design and performance evaluation of general mobile networks, not necessarily only robotic, but also I think for social networks, like transportation networks. Something that I'm also trying to do is look at biological networks. And now here what I'm doing is a lot of people work on bio-inspired robotics. Here what I'm trying to do is robotics or controls-inspired biology, in the sense that I'm trying to explain some behaviors that you see in biological systems using tools that we have developed in robotics, control, algorithms, okay, to get some additional insight that can explain some observed phenomena. Okay, so sorry for going a little bit over time, and thank you for your attention.
I'm surprised that for the multi-agent thing, your assignment is a zone algorithm, the zone defense.
Okay.
Much better transient performance, especially in the heavy load case, if you did some sort of receding horizon assignment. You sort of said, agent one will do this, this, and this, and agent two will do this, this, and this. And that, in some sense, defines the zones, but also makes them much more flexible.
Excellent point. I think that the answer here is, what is your notion of performance, right? So here, by performance, I'm really looking at the steady-state performance, right? So the steady-state performance doing, you know, things with this kind of like a, let's say, like a zone defense, will get you exactly the same performance as like the more reactive approach that you were mentioning. Probably, you know, the more reactive approach may give you a better transient again. Okay.
So if these are applications that the military are interested in, typically it's not a steady state temporal phenomena, but a very bursty phenomena. And I think in that case, the transient performance may not be the key thing.
So the transient will be the key, right? As I said, it's a good point. But you know, for example, for the kind of strategies that you were thinking of, is maybe you need somebody to tell the agent, so you get this and this and this, and you get this and this and this, right?
Communicate, but that's exactly how the Air Force works.
Yeah. So okay. So in that case, what you have is an operator that tells, you know, the agents, you know, go do this and this and this, right? So of course, I mean, probably you can get, you know, better performance that way. Really, what I'm thinking of for these systems is really a persistent infrastructure. Okay. I think that I actually have a slide. Blah 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 blah. I was not planning on showing all this thing. Just. So essentially what I want to have is a persistent infrastructure, and in the sense that I have some users on, you know, some infrastructure that provides a service, okay? So for example, I have a service for soldiers on the ground that they can say on a PDA or something, get me a picture, you know, show me what is hiding behind that corner, okay? These soldiers don't care about, they don't have, you know, any direct interaction with the UAVs. The UAVs are just flying over there all the time, okay? And the persons who operate the UAVs, they don't do the tasking. You know, persons operating the UAVs are just checking the health, making sure that they come back when they need to refuel, so on and so forth, right? And then what you have is this system that is automatically, you know, picking up the requests from the ground troops and figuring out automatically which of the airplanes should go, right? Given the fact that one of the airplanes has been recalled to the base for refueling, how should the other vehicles retask or, you know, reposition themselves? Okay, and so what I'm thinking of for this is something that really is, you know, like long-term persistent infrastructure that operates in as much autonomously as is possible, right? And then you have the users on one side, and then you have somebody monitoring the network on the other side, making sure that, you know, extremely bad things don't happen. But it's just a monitoring problem as opposed to tasking, you know, as it is now. Okay, so probably you can get better performance, but then you need to train these people, have 5 people per UAV as it is done today. Right. So that's, you know, performance cost analysis.
Is there a complication if I allow different agents to have different velocities?
Another excellent question. So there are complications because actually in that case the Voronoi diagrams become what are called the multiplicatively, well, you understood, weighted Voronoi diagrams, which do not have the nice properties of being polygonal. So things get much more hairy. But that is only if you need to compute the Voronoi diagrams explicitly. Right. Now, if you do the game version of this, doesn't matter. So the game version works in the case in which, you know, all agents can have all different speeds. I do not know the density function, so it's actually a very robust and, you know, way of doing this. And, you know, it requires very minimal infrastructure, no communication, still converges to a good set of configurations. Okay. But of course, converges very slowly, so the military will not like it. But, you know, there is.
Okay. Its algorithms mix and it's due with hard constraints, for example, time constraints or capacity constraints, where a particular customer must be serviced by a particular time, or you're picking up and delivering material.
So probably what you have in mind here is another class of those vCorrupting problems, which are called the vCorrupting problems with time windows. Okay, of course, the vCorrupting problems are already very hard. You put time windows, you make them even harder. Okay, really, you know, the closest approximation to what I have in mind, which I think is more applicable to this, you know, real world kind of like a dynamic routing problems, is this kind of problems where you have impatience. Okay. Where is it? Okay, let me show you. I think that here there is a simulation. Okay? So here you have a situation where you have these targets that appear. Okay? They're not going to stay there forever. Okay? They're not just sitting there for you to go do bad things to them or, you know, do good things. They may disappear after a while. Now, the fact that, unlike the case with time windows, it's not that you know how long they will be in the environment, right? So you don't know how long they will wait for you. You just know that, you know, they may disappear after some time, which is itself, this time is a random variable, for which, for example, you have an expectation, for example. Okay? And now what you're trying to do is minimize the percentage of, or, you know, minimize the probability that you will lose a particular target. Okay, or in general, minimize the percentage of targets that you will lose. Okay, you cannot guarantee that you will get every single one of them. You can only guarantee that the percentage of the one that you lose is below a certain threshold. Okay.
Yeah. So you've sort of done a comparison of sort of this nearest neighbor greedy approach versus the density cluster, and argued that the density cluster was the best asymptotically as the number of events goes to infinity. Do you have results? Can you weight that if you say I know I'm only going to have 1,000 events this day, or only a million events?
So that's another good point. So if you look at this, I don't know how well you can see this plot. What happens is that really the performance of I think that the performance of the nearest neighbor policy is about 0.7 or something like that, okay? 0.68 or something like that. Okay? So you can kind of like draw a line at halfway between 0.5 and 1, okay? And that really, you know, gives you an idea of where the performance for a given finite value of lambda sits with respect to the performance of the nearest neighbor, okay? So then you can say, you know, for example, if lambda is equal to 10, then maybe it's better to use the nearest neighbor policy, okay? But if lambda is, for example, is say 50 or, you know, some other value, then you can find a value of eta such that the performance of the distance cluster will be higher than the performance of the nearest neighbor. Okay. Of course, this is always, you know, like a stochastic result, right? And always steady state. Okay. Just clarify that question.
Your samples that you're trying to get in your cluster?
So you had this residual horizon strategy, right? That in which you kind of like, you know, select essentially what is the group that I should contains at least an eta fraction that I should service in minimum time, essentially. Okay? And essentially, as you make this fraction smaller and smaller, your system will be more and more reactive, and your performance will increase.
I mean, that would still seem, that's still applying to the case as number of events goes to infinity. I mean,
Okay. So, but keep.
If your number of events is one.
So, okay. So, I mean, of course, these results are rigorously proven only in the asymptotic case, right? But if you actually do some experiments, and actually, this is amazing, this limit here, this limit here is the limit for, this is, you know, what everything is based upon, okay? So essentially this says, you know, if you forget the limit, multiply this guy from the other side, you know that the expected length of the optimal traveling salesman tour through n points scales as beta times the square root of n. You do this experiment for already for 10 points, you get to within probably 5% accurate. Okay, so you know this estimate is within 5% of the actual cost. Okay, so even though the results are in principle asymptotic, as long as the number of points in your cluster is around 10, you're doing fine. Okay, actually, it's a very good approximation. Okay, but if you want to have the exact result, lambda has to be, you know, one gazillion targets. Right, but in practice, it's, you know, you don't need to get that far. Okay, so the convergence is quite rapid.
All right, I think let's thank Emilio again for this very interesting talk. Okay. There will be time for some questions afterwards. Okay.
Okay.